The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Hi, I'm Bob McChesney, back at Media Matters with you today on WILL AM 580 here in beautiful Urbana. We're talking about journalism, news, democracy, entertainment, and journalism. And in the studio with me today as my guests are Michael Della Carpini and Bruce Williams, who are co-authors of a forthcoming book, and the title of it is... Well, this is a long title. You can try to take a bunch of lines in your CVs, guys. What's this? And the walls came tumbling down, eroding boundaries between the news and entertainment and what they mean for mediated politics in the 21st century. That's a handful. And that really explains it all. I guess we don't have to do the show. That title is really truth in advertising. Well, first let me introduce the two gentlemen I've got here in the studio. Michael Della Carpini, who is an officer at the Pew Charitable Trust, has been the chairman of the Department of Political Science at Barnard College, the author of a great deal, including fairly recently, What Americans Know About Politics and Why It Matters, plus three other books. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So you're just in town now in Urbana visiting Bruce.
Visiting and working with Bruce.
On the book.
On the book, exactly.
Putting the finishing touches on it.
Finishing touches and trying to make the working title a little shorter.
Well, actually, I like the title. I didn't mean to give you a hard time. It took up half the show.
You just have to work on the delivery.
I think so, yeah. The voice you just heard was that of Bruce Williams, also the co-author and a colleague of mine here at the University of Illinois in the Institute of Communications Research. You're also in the faculty, Bruce, of the Department of Urban and Regional Planning.
That's correct.
Author of numerous books, most recently Democracy Dialogue and Environmental Disputes. And you guys go back a long way, all right? You went to grad school together?
Grad school together at the University of Minnesota, that's right, back in the
mid-'80s?
Somewhere in the mid-'80s, late
70s. Hey, I'm just trying to get in your will. Okay, always. And both distinguished authors who've done a lot of work on media and politics. And the research, I think, is really pace-setting from what I've seen. That's why we have you on the show. Thank you very much for coming and joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Before we get started, though, let me just say to our listeners, this is a pre-tape show so we could take advantage of Michael's being in town. So you can't make any calls today. So sit back, jack up the volume, make a cup of tea, enjoy yourself, and let us do all the talking for the next 54 minutes. Okay, so the book, Journalism, Entertainment. What's the thesis of the book? What's the argument you're making?
Well, what we've been as two people who've tried to write a lot about media and politics, we think that the media environment, quite obviously, within which we try and understand the relationship between media and politics, is very different now than it was just 15 years ago. And one of the things, and we can talk later about what we think has changed, but one of the results of that change is that there doesn't seem to be a clear line between entertainment and the news. And the deeper Michael and I got into researching this topic, the less clear that distinction became to us. And so we think that, in fact, that the very distinction between news and entertainment is something that really originates or is solidified in media in the 20th century. It doesn't really much exist before then, and it doesn't really exist. It's not very helpful for how we understand the media today. We think that more and more there are elements of what we would consider traditional sort of entertainment values entering into the news. Journalists are celebrities. They get paid enormous salaries. Increasingly, there are cross tie-ins between news shows and the rest of the shows that a network has, and on and on. At the same time, a lot of primetime shows, movies, music, cover issues that are timely, that are politically important, and that really are address the same sorts of issues that the news addressed. And none of this, this notion that the line has blurred, is particularly original with us. A lot of people have kind of observed that. But what our take is a little different, because most people who observe that blurring tend to be professional journalists or people who accept that distinction between news and entertainment. And so they think that this blurring is a bad thing. It's sort of a fall from grace. And we think that that we need to look at that question of the distinction between news and entertainment a little differently. We think that, in fact, in this new media environment, there are a lot of exciting potentials for media in terms of encouraging civic discourse, in terms of broadening the bounds of political debate, if we think much more broadly about which media really are politically relevant.
All right. And so this isn't a new thing, though. I mean, you're saying that actually the aberration was the distinction between journalism and entertainment. I mean, that was a 20th century phenomenon or more recent phenomenon that sort of had a rise and fall. Now we're returning to the state that existed in a very different context, obviously, the state that existed in the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries.
I think in a lot of ways that's right, that if you look more long-term at the role of the media, the press, in the United States at least, that if you look at the 18th and 19th centuries for sure, that this distinction between what's entertainment and what is news or public affairs really was not drawn, and certainly not drawn nearly as sharply as it was in the first half of the 20th century. That if you go back and look at old newspapers in the 18th and 19th centuries, one of the things you find is that it is much more of a pastiche of very different kinds of stories that are poems, political diatribes, no distinction between fact and opinion, no distinction between social and cultural issues and political issues, less distinction between the personal and the political, and that as we moved into a more of an industrial society and more in a corporate society, one of the things you find as we move into the 20th century is that first newspapers and then with the advent of radio and television, we entered a period where, not unlike the period we're in right now, where there was a crisis about what the relationship between the media and politics should be. The crisis was that if we believe as a nation that free, independent press and free speech is crucial to a democratic society, how do you explain that in a world in which, at the turn of the century from the 19th to the 20th, fewer and fewer people owned and had access to the media? The solution, to simplify a little bit at that time, was, well, maybe you don't need to have a really diverse, multiply owned, multiply ideological media. If you can have a media that has experts, they become journalists, who have who can give the facts and be objective, then people can draw their own conclusions from that. So it doesn't matter as much if you're only getting information from one or two sources because they're just giving you the facts.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are problems with that, obviously.
That's the rise of what we call professional journalism.
Exactly.
Neutral journalists, independent of the whims of the owners or advertisers or commercial pressures.
That's right. And our argument is twofold. Number one is that never worked, that there's a certain fiction in assuming that a handful of trained professionals can provide some notion of the objective truth that really replicates the kind of free-flowing market of ideas approach that is at least theoretically behind the American press and its relationship to democracy. So it was always a flawed model. But flawed or not, over the last 15 to 20 years, a number of technological and political and social changes have taken place that even if you adhere to that old model, make it impossible to work anymore, that journalists, like it or not, have lost control of the political agenda.
Now, interesting enough, I mean, because being a media historian and scholar myself, traditionally someone would listen to what you guys have said so far, Bruce and Michael, and say, yeah, we look at the horrors that professional journalism came out of, sensationalism, sloppiness, rabid pro-business, anti-labor partisanship. And you're saying we're heading back towards those days. And most people say, okay, this is a critical book. This can be saying this is a problem, what's happening now, and this is pointing us in a very negative direction. But the twist is you guys are saying, your argument is that not necessarily.
Right.
That there's this actually, we should not judge it by those terms. There's something else that might be going on that this has potential to be good in a traditionally democratic sense. Is that a fair way to put it?
I think that's right. And one of the things, I mean, that that you pointed out, Bob, that I think is important, is that the very notion that there ought to be a clear distinction between news and entertainment, and that there ought to be these professional journalists that stand at the gates between the booming, buzzing, blooming confusion of the political world and the citizenry, that whatever the advantages and disadvantages of that idea, that is an idea that develops pretty late in American history. It holds sway for a relatively short period of time. And as we enter what we would call a new media regime, characterized by things like, you know, the explosion of cable outlets, the internet, all sorts of new sorts of entertainment options, video games, video cassettes, and on, that in figuring out how we can best structure that system to serve democratic purposes, we are we're really limiting ourselves if we only look at that model of professional journalism, that we ought to look at the full sweep of American media history, to go back to periods that have been sort of vilified from the perspective of this model of professional journalism, but have a lot to offer.
We'll do that in the show today. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580. Our guests, Michael Della Carpini and Bruce Williams, co-authors of the forthcoming And the Walls Came Tumbling Down, on the eroding boundaries between news and entertainment and what they mean for politics and life in the coming decades and generations. Let's get a little more concrete here, because I think we've been a little abstract, and I know all our listeners are wondering if this is going to be on the final exam. What are some examples of the erosion that are taking place? So what's taking place in the last 10 years and currently in American media that indicate the process of the breakdown of the separation between journalism and entertainment? And let's just talk about some of that so people can sink their teeth into this. Mike?
Give one concrete example. Think about television show on ABC that went off the air relatively recently, Politically Incorrect. You could argue that Politically Incorrect is the prototype of what's new in the new media environment.
That's all about merging the two.
What does it do? It brings together celebrities, experts, journalists, sitting around discussing in a way that I think is imminently understandable, really important issues that oftentimes are ignored by the news. Any traditional definition of what is news would have to include Politically Incorrect if you really think about what we mean by news. Is it on a timely topic? Yes. Is it? Does it prevent different points of view? Yes. Does it include a discussion that is both opinion and fact? Yes.
Is it on too late for me to watch?
Is it on too late for people to watch? Yes. Does it not? Does it do it in a way that is entertaining? Yes. But entertainment in and of itself is not necessarily a bad thing. Think about the terms we use. We distinguish news or public affairs. One of the ways we distinguish it is we say, well, what it is not is popular culture. Think a little bit about that. Because something is popular does not make it unnewsworthy, especially in a democratic society.
Yeah.
That something being popular is not an indication that it is or is not newsworthy. So one of the things we're saying is you really need to have different criteria for deciding whether something is or is not useful in a democratic society.
Now, of course, someone like I could see a journalism professor at any distinguished journalism school who's done 20 years in a newsroom at a major newspaper immediately sort of throwing down their pipe and smashing their fists on the table saying, but Politically Incorrect, you're watching a soap opera star and a stripper and a professional basketball player talk about world trade. They don't know what the heck they're talking about. So garbage in, garbage out. If they watch the McNeil Lear report, they're going to be getting crack experts from the Pew Charitable Trust and all sorts of think tanks and government officials, reliable information that citizens need to really make informed decisions. What's your take on that, Bruce?
I think that they're clearly – we're not saying that there's no role for a show like McNeil Lear or whatever it is.
Lear.
Just Lear now. Yeah. But if you look at the audience for that show, and if you look at the audience for a lot of shows like that, they're very much aimed at an elite audience, and they have a small viewership. We think that in a democratic society, it's important to activate the entire citizenry as much as we can, to engage them in political issues, to model for them not just how to absorb information from experts, but how to wrestle with the important issues of the day themselves. And one of the things we think about that it's important about Politically Incorrect is that it models what we would call democratic practice. It shows people who disagree with each other, who are nevertheless, you know, they're not coming to blows. They're engaging each other. They're using humor to further engage an audience. I think that, in fact, on the last show of Politically Incorrect, one of the things that someone said was that one of the real contributions of this show is it showed that people could disagree seriously about the issues of the day and still be friends. Mm-hmm. We think that is an important lesson for people to learn. We think that that is an essentially political lesson. It's at the heart of democracy.
And now they're going to have to watch it on reruns if they want to learn that lesson.
Well, and that's a really important point. I'm going to just follow up on what Bruce said, that it's not only that the audiences are limited for a lot of these more elite shows, but the guests themselves are limited. You're right that there are some experts that you can see on the Lehrer NewsHour that you probably won't see on some of these other shows. But there are people that you'll see on some of these other shows that you won't, and more entertainment-oriented shows, and ideas that you'll hear that you won't hear on the Lehrer show, that independent analyses of the guests that appear as experts on even good public affairs broadcasting like PBS airs. Suggest that they're very limited. They're the same set of the usual suspect of elites that don't represent a cross-section of ideas in the United States. You're not going to hear discussions about issues that really resonate with people, I think, on some of those shows being discussed by people who take a point of view that are outside the mainstream nearly as often as you do in entertainment media.
No, but at the same time, though, I mean, this show has gone off the air for... And I don't think it went off the air because, to my knowledge, they thought it was bad journalism or they were upset at that model, but rather they just weren't making enough money.
Well, and that, I think, is part of what we're trying to argue, that if we found it very interesting, and we've written quite a bit about the controversy over the flirtation of ABC with David Letterman to replace Nightline.
This is earlier in the year 2002, and I mean, just for our listeners who might not be watching TV at that time of night, the Nightline show goes against David Letterman and Jay Leno. It's the serious news show hosted by Ted Koppel for two decades. And ABC, which is owned by Disney, was negotiating to get rid of that show and replace it with David Letterman, move him over from CBS. Just a background.
Right. And that that flirtation of ABC with David Letterman, it got an enormous amount of press coverage. It became a controversy, and the way the controversy played out is there were those typically who defended the kind of traditional journalism that Ted Koppel did as saying, this is something that is beyond just making money here. That this is a kind of a public service, that journalism ought to be protected in some sense from overt commercial pressures. Although it is interesting that... In fact, Koppel and Letterman have about the same ratings. It's just that Letterman's audience is younger and so more desirable to advertisers. But nevertheless, that there was a public discussion started by journalists in the media who were really upset that they were taking off this what they thought was a valuable show, Ted Koppel's Nightline. Mm-hmm. And in the end, for one reason or another, Koppel is still on and will be for a while.
Do you think we should have the same debate about Politically Incorrect?
Yes, because we think that it is the kind of continuing adherence to this, we think, at best arbitrary distinction between news and entertainment that allows you to have this discussion about Ted Koppel, but a much more muted discussion about Bill Maher and Politically Incorrect. Further, one of the reasons that Maher went off is that after September 11th, he made a very controversial statement on Politically Incorrect, where he said that he thought that whatever else you might want to accuse the terrorists of being, it was wrong to accuse them of being cowards. You know, they flew airplanes into buildings. And that, and here's the really controversial part. He said, if you want to talk about cowardly acts, let's talk about lobbing cruise missiles into countries while you're standing hundreds of miles off.
2,000 miles away.
2,000, yeah. Okay. And that caused enormous controversy. We would argue that, that Bill Maher tried to address that controversy head on in a really sort of interesting and important way, not fully backing away from it, explaining why he said that. But nevertheless, what got the show in trouble is advertisers pulled out. And that, and he said later on that he packed his office that week because he knew he wasn't going to be able to stay on ABC. Now, we think that...
Isn't it ironic he learned what truly is politically incorrect?
Yeah, exactly.
That's right. That's right.
But we think that, if you think about the reasons that we want an open, vibrant debate in the media, why we, you know, that clearly politically incorrect deserves to be addressed in those terms. And it's only because we think that there is this small part of the media that we label the news. And mm-hmm. that's where public service obligations apply. That's where, you know, we need to think about responsibility to public values. And we think that in the media environment now, that debate needs to be extended much more broadly.
With me in the studio is Bruce Williams, you just heard. Also here is Michael Della Carpini. They're the co-authors of a new book, And the Walls Came Tumbling Down, The Eroding Boundaries Between News and Entertainment and What It Means. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Today, Media Matters. We're taping this show because Michael Della Carpini is just in town for a brief time. We wanted to get him in the studio, so we aren't taking phone calls. Please don't call. Just sit back, enjoy yourself, and let us do the talking for the next 40 minutes or so here on Media Matters. Michael, what are some other examples besides politically incorrect? I mean, good examples in your view. I think you guys, it's clear, I think politically incorrect actually served a very positive
That's right.
Role in getting debate going and raising issues and getting people to think politics is something that you should participate
That's
in.
That's right. That's right.
What are some other examples that would you would put in that same group?
Well, I think if you think about two shows, and again, not coincidentally, shows that are no longer on the air, that Michael Moore, director and producer and writer of the documentary Roger and Me, had on the air. One was called
TV Nation.
The second was The Awful Truth. Both of them hard-hitting, funny, satirical programming that was aimed at dealing with very substantive, real-world political issues, but doing it in a way that was informative and engaging.
Mm-hmm.
I think that you would see issues being addressed on those shows, issues of corporate crime, many months prior to the Enron and WorldCom scandals, issues that dealt with fair wage issues of the civil rights and liberties of indigent people, issues of the criminal justice system.
Yeah, this sounds like a left-wing bookstore. I mean, your point about Moore, though, I mean, to get to the issue, is that he's also an extraordinarily entertaining person.
Exactly.
I mean, he also would do things like on TV Nation where he had a thing where he wanted to hug all 50 governors.
That's right. That's right.
And so, I mean, it was a hilarious skit because you had governors hiding in the men's room to avoid
that's
him.
That's right. That's right. And it's humorous with a point, and yeah. It's humorous and educational at the same time.
Are there right-wingers doing this, or is it just guys like Michael Moore? I mean,
I know that this is going to stick in your craw, Bob.
But
someone that we write actually quite positively about is Rush Limbaugh. Even though we don't agree with any of his political perspectives, I think that he is someone who is entertaining, he's funny, and at the same time, I think that he encourages his listeners to be active in politics, to keep informed, to be critical of the information they're getting,
mm-hmm.
and I think that he's someone who does a pretty good job at that. Another person who I like, although I don't think, you know, he strictly is a writer, is someone like P.J. O'Rourke, who deals, again, comes at things from a very right-wing perspective, but I think P.J. O'Rourke is relatively open to debate. He's funny, he's entertaining, and I think that presenting serious issues in a way that is entertaining and yet doesn't trivialize those issues is really the challenge that the new media presents. And I think that we ought to really look for the figures that are able to do a good job at that. I think that
who
part
all,
of our,
who are now all off the air, at least if they're not the right wingers.
That's right.
And I think, Rush Limbaugh didn't have a good experience on TV, but your point is
he was fat then. He lost
so
weight.
So was Michael Moore, right?
Yeah, that's right. I think that's why I'm on radio.
We've covered the real reason these shows don't last.
Now, let me ask you another question. One point that seems clear is that more Americans, that's the right term, probably learn about the world and politics from programs like the ones we're talking about than they do from the Lair Hour or the evening news, perhaps, or even the daily newspaper. And I've read, and you probably write about this in your book, at least if you don't, you should know, that something like Jay Leno's monologue has an extreme importance in the view of politicians because they know how many millions of Americans who might vote are much more likely to pick up on what's happening from a Jay Leno joke than they will from a newspaper article or a TV news broadcast or discussion on the Lair News Hour. Is that an example of what you're talking about?
It is, but it's a really interesting example because part of what we're trying to argue is that it's not necessarily the case that because something is entertainment or news by the labels that we put on it, that it's automatically good or bad. The impact of a Jay Leno or a David Letterman is clearly great. The New York Times during the last election would weekly print what Jay Leno and David Letterman were talking about as part of their news coverage because they knew it was politically important. All the candidates followed what Jay Leno and Letterman was saying because they knew that it was going to have a bigger impact than what was on the news. That doesn't automatically make it good, though. I mean, one of our arguments is that Leno and Letterman, they don't really have a political point of view. If you look at their monologues, it's satirical and cynical. What it leads to is a sense of cynicism about all politics.
Yeah.
But it's powerful and important, and so you've got to pay attention to it.
It also seems, my sense is, and this is not scholarly work, but this is purely anecdotal and impressionistic, is that they find for a politician, say George W. Bush, he's the dummy. Clinton's the womanizer.
Right. That's right.
They find sort of one shtick for each guy, or maybe two, and usually it's a guy. And then they just hammer the jokes on that,
exactly.
Beat it into the ground. So it's unlike politically incorrect or something. We're getting
issues and
various
perspectives. And various perspective, exactly. I mean, I think it's really telling that what a transitional period we're in, that after 9/11, at the same time that the news shows upped the amount of time they were on the air and took on special importance, David Letterman, Jay Leno, even politically incorrect, went off the air for a week or two because, and our argument would be that that happened because they didn't know what their role was supposed to be now. They didn't stay on the air because they were clearly relevant to this, but they couldn't, but they also couldn't air anything because they didn't know what an appropriate role was. I think part of what that says to us is that we need to think as a society about what is the role of different kinds of media in educating and informing the American public and in providing them with a outlet for discourse about really important issues.
Bruce, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and we think that part of our plea in the book is that someone like a Jay Leno or a David Letterman it's a cop-out. It's being dishonest for them to say that they're just entertainers or they're not really they're not journalists, so they shouldn't be held to any sort of standards of professional accountability. We think that the basic question you want to ask about media in a democratic society is how does it serve, at least one of the questions you have to ask is how does it serve democratic purposes, and that anyone who holds the media soapbox has to think about those responsibilities. And so part of collapsing or thinking outside this distinction between news and entertainment is trying to argue for how different figures in the media environment, whether they be citizens who are consuming media, whether they be political figures, whether they be journalists, whether they be cultural and quote-unquote entertainment figures, how they all, the kinds of values they ought to think about as they enter this new media environment.
You know, let me play the devil's advocate here.
Sure.
To take another side to this. During the 2000 presidential election, when Ralph Nader was running for president, Michael Moore was a big supporter of Ralph Nader and traveled around the country with him, speaking with him for a couple months. And he came to Madison, Wisconsin. I had the privilege to be there and see the event. And Moore gave his hilarious introductory talk before Nader came on. And Nader came on and he said, "Isn't that Michael Moore great?" And people said, "Yeah, Michael Moore's the greatest. You know, this is what a breakthrough that we have someone like Michael Moore." And Nader, interestingly enough, his comment was, "Actually, this is not a good thing at all." He said, "You know, the best political satire he ever saw in his life was in the old Soviet Union, because it was impossible to discuss issues in the official media. It was so closed down. So it was reduced to satire, and it reflected the impotence of the political culture and the lack of democracy. But it meant you had great humor. I mean, you had 50 Shecky Moors or, you know, out there in the Soviet Union." And so he said this, you know, his argument was in the 1960s, he could get on commercial television, a Mike Douglas show or a Merv Griffin show, routinely. He was the number one guest on those shows in the 1960s to talk about very serious issues. And he would be on in the 1960s on those shows with jugglers and singers and comedians raising those types of issues. And he said, you know, since Donahue went off the air, basically he's been shut out of those shows for 15 years. And now it's down to comedians. I mean, he sort of looked at this process from a very different perspective. This is a sign that we should be really alarmed by the decadence and decay in our political culture.
I think that a big supporter of Ralph Nader, but I really disagree with that perspective, because I think that some of that is that the plausibility, the surface plausibility of that argument comes from just some of the examples that we've just been throwing around here and the fact that Michael Moore introduced him. I think that if you think about more serious
about the 60s stuff, for example, I mean, because we're all from the same generation. I remember in the 1960s seeing on shows like Mike Douglas and Merv Griffin exactly what Nader described, comedian from Las Vegas, a singer, and Gore Vidal talking about their latest book. And sort of as a 14- or 15-year-old kid watching this, it was very influential on me. I was exposed to ideas. And you wouldn't. I mean, do you see that? That's sort of counter evidence, really, to the trajectory you're talking about? Or does it not – how does it fit in?
Well, I think that there are – I mean, if – I think that – there are certainly shows that bring together people from, you know, wide varieties of backgrounds and have them not – and again, you know, if my memory of Merv Griffin serves, you know, what you're going to have is you're going to deal with Ralph Nader for 10 minutes and then you're going to turn on and you know, you're going to turn around and hear kind of Shecky Green for 10 minutes. Again, Politically Incorrect is a show that brings together all those people and they really engage each other. And I think that kind of engagement and conversation is very important. But to go past the examples we've been talking about, I think there are a variety of media. For example, the movies, which are extraordinarily powerful in dealing with issues that are of, you know, central political importance in a lot of different ways. They don't. Sometimes they do it humorously. Sometimes they do it much more seriously. I think that that a movie like The Hurricane, or the movie by Denzel Washington about Reuben Hurricane Carter is something we talk about in our book, and we kind of, there are good things and bad things about it, but it's a very serious attempt to deal with issues of race and the criminal justice system.
Mm-hmm.
I think it fails on a lot of dimensions. Another area where I think that where there is a show that does enormous good, that serves at least as much of a public purpose as most news broadcasts, is a show like The West Wing. Michael and I are two political scientists by training, and I think we both agree that someone who watches The West Wing learns more about the way the political system works, at least as the way we learned about it as political scientists, and we write about it as political scientists, than you do if you just watch the news every night.
And to go to the heart of your question, these kind of things have always been. You're right. In the 60s, you saw it. In the 50s, you saw it. There have always been, you know, Richard Nixon appeared on Laugh-In. There has always been some of this overlap. And part of the reason for that is because the line has been really artificial. But I think you can make a strong case, at least we make a strong case, I think, that that the amount of this and the scope of it and the reach of it is much greater now than has ever been the case in the past.
You're listening to Michael Della Carpini and Bruce Williams, the co-authors of the forthcoming And the Walls Came Tumbling Down, Eroding Boundaries Between News and Entertainment, today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a tape show, so we're taping it prior to going on the air, so we aren't taking calls. Just sit back and relax and enjoy the last 20 minutes or so. You know, I don't want to dwell on this point, but I mean, I think it's such a fascinating thesis. But take the example of films that you just gave, Bruce, and how films are sort of moving or covering political issues and a source of political education. I'm not an expert in films, but you know, I've watched my share until I had children. Now I only watch the G ones, and I know all about the those brilliant political films. But you know, if you look back at the 1970s, for example, when I think of what Hollywood was turning out, I think you could make a plausible case that the political content was, at the very least, equal to what we have now, and arguably considerably way above it in terms of interesting sort of political takes on the world. Movies that weren't formulaic, that dealt with social issues, that dealt with sort of people you wouldn't normally see. I mean, and really dealt with social issues in a way that I think more so. And not to give counter evidence again, but I mean, how do you guys...
Well, I think that I fully agree with your point. But I think that at least the way we see it is that it is more important, in some sense, it is more important now that we think about ways to encourage just that sort of media that you've described. It's much more important now than I think it was in the 1970s. And one of the reasons is that when it came to the transmission of, you know, political information through the media, because you still had in the 60s and 70s this old system where something like 80% of all households were watching one of the three nightly news broadcasts any given night. You had most people were going to the same place. They were developing a sort of common set of images and issues, and that has advantages and disadvantages. But we are in a much different environment now, where the sources of information, the sheer number of television stations, of videos, of movies, to say nothing of the internet, they really have exploded, we think, the conduits through which people seek political information. Mm-hmm. And so I think that as much as I like the movies of the 70s, I think I would argue that it's more important that we think about how to get people in Hollywood to think about that public responsibility rather than think about just, you know, the number of tickets they sell on the opening weekend of a movie.
Well, I think that's a good explanation. But then it seems what we're getting at, Michael, is really that the traditional notions of journalism are the one that have really collapsed. They're the failure is there to a large extent. So even if the movies aren't more politically oriented today, the need for them to take up these issues is greater because traditional types of journalism, and they're part of the problem with traditional journalism goes to the problems of professionalism you talked about earlier, and also something we haven't talked about a great deal, sort of the entertainment infusion into the what's conventional journalism, the decline
that's
of
right.
professional
that's right.
journalism.
Because that's exactly the flip side of what we're talking about is that as artificial as some of the norms of traditional journalism might be, that you can be objective, that you can just give the facts, that you can provide all the information that is necessary for people to know and do it in a neutral, fair way, as hard as it would be to do that, we're in an environment in which, because of the collapse that we're talking about, journalism is failing to do that nearly as well as it did even in its peak. And it's failing for a couple of reasons. One is because of the challenge of 24-hour information, because of the challenge of needing to be more economically competitive as the norms of journalism begin to erode, and because for political reasons, some of the standards that were put in place in a regulatory way, the fairness doctrine, equal protection, limits on ownership of the media, those are all declining. as those things decline, what you have is a news media that feels threatened in terms of its viability in this new information environment, and feels little or less obligation to hold to some of those standards. And so I think you could argue that watching campaign coverage on the nightly news, whether it's local or national, that a good deal of what you'll see in that coverage is less politically relevant than what you're going to get by watching an episode of The Simpsons.
Yeah, no, sometimes. I think clearly it's just, it emerges during the show. It seems like we're getting at the argument here at the end rather than the beginning, because it's really a strong critique about the limitations of what's happening in conventional
Absolutely.
Journalism. Combined, it seems like, with the sense that there's no hope for reform from within the system, that when conventional journalism uses entertainment, it uses it basically so it can make more money or do lousier journalism, not to do better journalism. When art or entertainment goes to politics, it uses entertainment so it can do something more interesting.
Well, and I think the point that we'd make is that you need to make that evaluation that you just made on a case-by-case basis or by looking at the larger media environment, that you can't just start from the premise that if it's on after the nightly news during prime time, it's not political. But if it's on during that 5:30 to 6:30 slot and it's produced by the news division of a station, that is automatically political. Mm-hmm. That you're going to find a tremendous amount that currently falls under the news that is useless for people. That's going to tell you about the strategy of why a particular bill or piece of legislation was being considered, not the substance of it. And it's equally as likely that you can turn on, as I said, an episode of The Simpsons and get as much information about how corporate society works in the United States as you might ever get on a news broadcast.
Now, how much wiggle room is there in our system? This is an issue that's come up throughout the show. We're talking about The Simpsons has still survived and hung in there, but Politically Incorrect, the Michael Moore programs, these shows have struggled to survive commercially. And, you know, what we've talked about in both those cases are advertisers, the need for profits, the concern for advertisers and owners not to do something that might antagonize powerful interests, commercial and political, on one hand. And then with terms of commercial journalism or mainstream professional journalism, tremendous commercial pressures that promote this entertainment. I mean, it's less expensive. It's seen as more profitable. No one does it because they think it's necessarily better journalism. There are other reasons. Is there a way out of this structural problem so we can foster the type of journalism you want? Otherwise, it seems like, you know, it's third and long.
Well, I think that one of the things that we argue is, and again, I go back to what Michael was saying about sort of case by case, because I think that this is a relatively unstable period in, I think, the development of media in the United States, because lots and lots is changing, and a lot of different actors are really trying to find their feet here in this new system. And I think at a time like that, it is possible to think about how some of these values might be explicitly addressed. I think one of the shows that is, for example, you talk about advertisers. I think that's a terribly important thing to think about, because even a large commercially oriented station like HBO, because it is not advertiser driven, because it's subscription driven, it can do, in our view, much more interesting, provocative, intelligent programming that is overtly political.
Aren't they doing just about the only social documentaries on television today, for all intents and purposes?
I think that's right.
Unless you count reality programming.
Well, let's talk about that, actually. Because that's something, you've got all these shows that are trying to connect with real people on the lives they lead as they get in there. Does that fit into your thesis in any way?
Yeah, I think it clearly does. And by reality programming, we mean more than the Survivor-type shows. I mean, we're talking about recently, over the summer, a couple of new test programs. One that's called Crime and Punishment, which is following real district attorneys in San Diego, I believe, as they do cases involving the criminal justice system, crime, murder cases, other kinds of cases. What this show?
Well, is this how they support the district attorney's office?
Well, it raises all really interesting issues. They've got and it's high production value. It's produced by not the news division of CBS or NBC. But by the entertainment division.
By the person who produces Law and
Order. The same producer of Law and Order. It's got three robotic cameras in the courtrooms in San Diego so that you get not the typical cinema verite type film, but high production value, entertainment type production. And at one level, because it is actually following real world cases, you could argue that it's a very effective glimpse into the criminal justice system. But it's totally from the point of view of the prosecutor's office. Every one of the pilot shows involves a case in which the district attorney wins the case, and it makes individual celebrities out of these district attorneys, so that you're as much captured by the sense of them as people as you are by the issues that underlie it. Counterpose that to an episode that was on The Awful Truth by Michael Moore that made a very important observation that in the particular local community that he looked at, out of every 901 cases that come to the public defender's office in which somebody goes to jail, 900 of those cases never went to trial. 900 out of 901.
So it would be a much more interesting show to see the backroom deals.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But if I could jump in, I think that one of the things that makes this question of this sort of reality programming even more interesting in terms of the things we've been talking about is there's another show that has just started on, I think it's ABC.
That's right.
It's called State Versus. And it is it's in Arizona.
That's right.
And again, it's the same sort of thing where they follow through a real case. But this is produced, interestingly enough, by ABC's news division. And so because of that, it's a slightly different kind of a show. And in fact, the people who produce the show talk about this very openly. They say, because this is the news division doing this, we have to show we're more obligated to show different sides. So they show the defense side as well. They also gained, I don't know how they did this, but they gained access to the jury rooms. They actually taped the jury deliberations. Now, I think that for us, that this whole thing is a really interesting kind of issue, because I think that one might, from a traditional journalistic perspective, you might just listen to this whole idea that this is done by the ABC News division basically to compete with Crime and Punishment. And a lot of that journalism professor you talked about earlier is going to throw his pipe down again and say, this is not what journalists should be doing.
Yeah.
But we think that in thinking about how, even within a news division, how to be entertaining and engaging, those are legitimate questions. They ought to be addressed in a serious way. The problem is they get bootlegged in all sorts of almost haphazard ways in terms of the celebrity of journalists, the pressure to cross-plug other things that the network's doing. And we think that the better way to think about this is if you're interested in communicating issues, developing a better understanding of the criminal justice system, whether it doesn't matter whether your show is produced by the entertainment division or the news division, the issues are exactly the same.
And the standards should be the same.
It strikes me, what motivates your work is a desire to see our society more politicized, to see there more public involvement. And that's the whole reason you're doing this. And I think your case is convincing. But the bottom line is that, the problem you're running up against is we live in an extraordinarily depoliticized society. The fact that Politically Incorrect, which was the most entertaining show, wasn't biased one way or the other, to deal with public issues in memory, is going off the air to be replaced by a show that is going to apparently avoid any sort of political issues.
Yeah.
And it's going to be discussing female anatomy and beer drinking and things like that, that we guys apparently are interested in exclusively. There's a really core problem here, which is that apparently political life seems sterile and uninteresting to an extraordinarily high number of Americans. And it also is, then there's not a market for this on one hand at the beginning, there's not much of one. How do you, I mean, what causes that? I mean, how much of the fact that there was passion in journalism and it was entertainment prior to the 20th century was that political life was interesting. There were debates going on. You took sides. I mean, there was parades. I mean, it was part of life. It was part of what being a person was in a country. And that's gone now. I mean, politics is just foreign to so many Americans.
Well, I think in some ways, I mean, several answers or potential answers to that question. Number one, at some level, the easiest answer to give is that I don't think a lot of these kinds of programs have been given a fair shake. I mean, it's politically incorrect, as you said, is on too late for you to even get a chance to watch it. The Michael Moore show was aired on Bravo, which the people in the country don't get, and also shown, I think, at 11:45 at night. Shows like The West Wing finish in the top 10, even though it's a little bit of a different kind of show. So on one level, I don't think it's been given a fair shake. But at a deeper level, I think your point is exactly what our book is about, I think, which is we have lived through a half a century in which politics has been stripped of any emotion. It's been ghettoized into a one-hour period at night on television that this is your schoolwork, watch the news, and then everything else has become depoliticized. In the end, it's the classic question that anyone, yourself included, that looks at the role of media in American politics faces. It's the chicken or egg question. To what extent does the media reflect what goes on in society, and to what extent is it a major source of why society is the way it is? And I think that's, in one level, unanswerable, but I think any common sense answer would say it's a little of both. And
Bruce, and both of you, actually, but I'll start with Bruce. We've only got a couple minutes left, and I think, you know, for people listening to the show who share your sentiments, who are concerned and want to improve the quality of journalism and public life, is there anything they can do about this? I mean, what can they do besides, you know, read your book? I mean, are there political things they can do? I mean, or can they just watch shows and buy the products being advertised on them?
Well, I think at the most,
this is going to be one of the shortest answers you've ever given.
Okay, I think that when they see a show that they really like, that's doing a good job at what they think is politically important, they ought to at least take the time to email or write a letter to the people who are producing that show that they really love it.
All right, thank you so much, Bruce Williams and Michael Della Carpini, for joining me in Media Matters today. It's been a pleasure having you here. I'm Bob McChesney, your host. Join us 1 week from today, 167 hours, for the next version of Media Matters. Thank you.